Choke points.
Let's go.
Taggers, be warned. The state is coming after your artwork with a high-tech gadget, and Chris met the man behind the state's new graffiti-battling drone.
It doesn't have a nickname, it doesn't have a fancy acronym, but it is packed with 8 motors, 150 feet of hose, intelligent collision avoidance, 2 batteries, and a 6-foot nozzle. If taggers can get there, so can this bad boy.
This is not your average buy-it-at Costco drone. Right. This is an industrial grade aircraft with a 6-foot long wand connected to an airless sprayer that's capable of, lots of pressure, meaning thrust.
And that's the key here. Most drone operators don't have to worry about a nozzle spraying paint, which adds a whole bunch of new physics to this party, because that when you move it, that pushes you backwards. Just imagine like expelling gas in space. You go the opposite direction. So that's one of the leveling things you have to understand when you're flying this drone. It's not like a typical drone. Mike Gogger is not your average drone operator, though. He's the head of WashDOT's Olympic Region Maintenance Unit and the man who decided to turn a drone into a sword against graffiti. Gogger has worked with drones for years because they have them at WashDOT for bridge maintenance and other applications to go places where people can't go. But they've never used it against graffiti. There are 10 pilots in the region, down in the Olympic region of WashDOT, but only 2 others have the skill to join Gogger at these controls.
You might be very good at flying one of those drones and have a lot of experience doing it. It doesn't qualify you to touch this one. It's a different animal.
And the reason is because of the hose that dangles below it. That's not something most operators have even considered.
It's not just a matter of being a normal drone pilot. There's an element of training that needs to go with the tethered aspect of it. You've got a hose connected to the ground. Some of the tendencies of drones that people get used to is, you can fly it till the battery gets weak, and when it's time, it knows, and it just comes back and lands. But it doesn't know that it has a hose attached to it. So having that happen could be detrimental.
Yeah, so imagine like if you're doing an ROV, if you've seen something on TV where they put ROVs into the water, remote operated vehicles, and it's got all the stuff with it. Well, if you get tangled up in the cords, that the same thing can happen here with this drone. So that's why it takes a lot of extra skill and training to get through this. Now, so far, Gogger and his crew have tested the drone 5 times in actual applications. The first time came over the biggest canvas in Tacoma, that giant wall along I-5 just after the Highway 16 interchange.
First tag was, big, 10, 12 feet long. And, in a short order, it was covered. Everybody there was smiling.
And you could tell, just listen to him, this guy's been in aviation before he came to WashDOT. And I could tell he was giddy about this. He was about as excited as I am. And I haven't even get to fly the thing. It's pretty exciting. Now, if you're not familiar with the spot there on I-5 that I talked about, not everybody gets down to Tacoma. It is at the very top of a very steep landscaped hillside with no shoulder at the bottom. It's just not safe to put people up there to do this kind of work.
We're never going to let our employees take the risk that graffiti artists take when they're up there. So literally they're risking their lives to be over live traffic with probably little or no protection.
And so that's part of what this drone is there to do, is to go those places where people can't and to keep his people safe. Now, the drone's going to be out in Pierce and Thurston counties for the rest of the year. For Gogger, it's about finding out if this is the right move to keep his people safe and the roadways clean.
We're planning to continue to do our research and actively go out and use it when it makes sense to, through the summer and fall. As we go into wintertime, it's hard to really get any paint out anyway, so that by the end of the year, we'll produce the research findings, the results.
And as you would imagine, Gogger's phone is ringing off the hook from transportation departments around the world to see how this thing is going. This is the first graffiti battling drone in operation, and the world is watching.
Each time we go out, the idea is to learn, is this going to be an acceptable maintenance practice for day-to-day use?
Well, we shall see.
I did not know that. This is the first one, the first time they tried this?
Yes,
really?
In this type of application.
In the world?
Yeah. Now, there are drones that have nozzles on them that they use to, say, do window washing and things like that. But no one has ever used it, as they can tell, to spray paint specifically to attack graffiti. There are also drones that do spray paint, but in an industrial application, like if you're going to do this, but nothing directed specifically at graffiti.
Now, is this the only one we have?
Yes. It's a prototype. The first one they got, they had to send back. It had a GPS problem because they found out when flying in areas under bridges and things where the GPS got kind of, and it only had one avoidance, it was like running into the walls. And they're like, okay, can you try something different? And now they've got almost 360 degree collision avoidance, because I mean, you think about it, you're a couple of feet away from a wall high up in the air, and it's moving around a bunch, and so it can figure out where it is a lot better. Now
we got AI now,
right? So this is drone number two,
but
by the way,
operated by man, so it's not necessarily AI controlled.
Yeah, but I mean, this would be what I would consider a great application for AI, as opposed to, you know, like writing news copy or some such nonsense. Have it clear the graffiti out. Now let me ask you something else.
Yeah,
now I know, you know what I'm thinking about now. What about lane striping? If you can get this thing to X out graffiti, imagine if they could just go scooting down the highway, redoing the lanes.
Now, with that, Dave, I'm going to fall on your physics expertise.
Yes.
To do a nozzle that is now facing downward would create automatic upward thrust.
Well, yeah.
So you would have to find a way to keep it stable enough very far.
Artificial intelligence, Chris. It can do anything.
But again, now to do that, they would also have to close a lot more lanes to do that.
More than they do now when they're striping, really?
Well, I mean, they'd have to close lanes as well. So I'm not sure if it would be any easier to get their four people, five people out there to run this thing, as opposed to just going over it with the striping machine.
Okay.
I think we just live in an area where paint striping just doesn't work well in the winter. and our lines are destined to disappear.
I feel like this would be a dream job for a kid who grew up playing video games. What were his special skills leading to this position?
He was kind of coy about what his previous 18 years in aviation was when he made his transition over. I'm going to look into that to see.
So he was part of the CIA.
Well, I didn't say anything about that.
That's what it means.
But he never thought that the two worlds of being a maintenance guy and an aviation guy would meet. Mm. And here they are.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. I mean, it's a pretty sizable drone. It seems to work pretty well.
Should I ask what it costs?
Let's just say, I think so far they've spent around $85,000 or $90,000 of dollars on a variety of things. And again, these are just some ballpark numbers because they haven't really put it all together. So far, after this program had actually started, the legislature has set aside $1 million for the program going forward and looking at this. You know, obviously you have training, you have FAA training to go under for these kinds of things. But yeah, why not? I mean, it's exciting. As I told these guys, I just imagine the Flight of the Valkyries playing in the background and just a fleet of drones popping up out of everywhere and just going to town.
Drone force.
The problem is now is the graffiti artists know this is out there. They've accepted it as a challenge. And so they're going out right away and tagging right back over and leaving messages for the DOT. The first time they put
this
up, they cleaned something on one of the bridges over the very hard to spot to get to. They had to do it with, well, this is before the drone, and it was painted over the very next day with a very little nice note to DOT. They would not describe exactly what was written, but it sounds like there's some cat and mouse going on here, certainly, and this
well,
has upped the
ante. All they have to do now when they clean off the graffiti is set up a camera there, and then you caught them, right? I mean, it's like...
Of course, then they're going to get their own drones.
Of course, yeah. I mean,
And we're going to have midair battles and paint battles.
Yes, the ante has been upped, Dave.
At Cape Canaveral, Boeing Starliner did not launch as scheduled last night. The launch was scrubbed with 2 hours left in the countdown because, according to CBS correspondent Peter King, the crew was hearing a disconcerting noise.
The launch crew at the top of the tower near where the capsule was, they heard this buzzing, and engineers were monitoring the valve that kept opening and closing and opening and closing. When you hear something you're not supposed to hear, that's not a good thing. So they decided to stand down and get the crew off the spacecraft. And of course, as soon as they got the crew off, the buzzing stopped.
So do they track it down? I mean, do they know what the problem was?
Well, they know what the problem was, but what they're not sure is if the valve is still got enough life in it to make the flight safely. So they're still analyzing that. There are only so many openings and closings that valve can do without wearing out. So they're running the data, as they like to say, and they hope to come up with a decision and a consensus sometime soon. Right now, the plan is to launch no earlier than Friday night.
Oh, okay. So it could go up in a few days. Remind us what the difference is between the Boeing Starliner and the SpaceX alternative.
I think there are more similarities than differences. They're both very, very smart spacecraft. I think the biggest differences are that, you know, SpaceX is completely integrated with its own rocket, the Falcon 9. The Boeing launch is on an Atlas V, which is made by United Launch Alliance and has decades of reliability. So there's that. And of course, SpaceX got their spacecraft up in the air back in 2020, the Crew Dragon. Boeing has yet to fly theirs with a crew aboard.
And is Boeing's at least partly reusable the way SpaceX's is?
It's absolutely completely reusable. In fact, this spacecraft flew one of the test flights and was refurbished when it landed. So if you look at pictures, you'll see a little bit of wear and tear. The Boeing spacecraft is designed to be flown 10 times or so. That's what it's certified for. But they may find that they can actually refly it as many as 15 or 20 times as life goes on.
Well, Boeing needs a win, so we're crossing our fingers for a successful launch in a few days.
Well, Boeing has a great space heritage, and, you know, it's good that they are taking the time to do it right, and I think everybody is rooting for them to get this off the ground successfully and back successfully. That's important, too.
CBS correspondent Peter King. Thank you, Peter.
Dave, always good to talk to you.
Let's go now to CBS military consultant Jeff McCausland, retired Army colonel, former dean at the U.S. Army War College, and get some perspective on what will or will not happen in Gaza now. So, first of all, what's the situation as you understand it? Is Israel invading or not?
Well, it's doing a bit of both today, and that is negotiating and invading simultaneously. We had this announcement last night that Hamas had accepted a ceasefire agreement, but it appears the agreement they accepted was not the agreement that the Israelis believed they had totally proposed. So I think we're having a bit of private negotiation on the details of an agreement, including a ceasefire and exchange of hostages, and then the public persona, both sides trying to blame the other for that failing to go through and trying to push to the maximum extent of their points. At the same time, the Israelis have begun at least a surgical attack against Rafah by sealing off the border crossing between Rafah and Egypt and conducting airstrikes and artillery strikes at certain locations and sending out information to up to 100,000 Palestinians in Rafah in one particular area in the very eastern portion of Rafah. They should flee the area northward towards Khan Yunis to an area the Israelis claim they have established, though frankly, aid workers from the UN and elsewhere have said they do not see the preparation in terms of infrastructure, tents, medical supplies, water, food, to accommodate that kind of a huge influx of refugees in that area.
Yeah, so how exactly do they move there? Do they walk? Can you drive? Are there buses being provided? How do you move out of the area?
Yeah, as refugees have moved throughout this particular conflict, and don't forget this particular town of Rafah, before the war, was a city of about 300,000. It now holds somewhere in excess of 1.3 million. And these are refugees that flowed south as Israel is advancing southward through the Gaza Strip by any means you can possibly imagine. A cart being pulled by a donkey, a car, a motorbike, a bicycle, a wheelchair, or just plain walking. There clearly is no transportation that I have witnessed and the things I've watched that the Israelis have arranged to move the population. How they move is totally the problem of the refugee.
1.3 million. So that's like about twice the population of the city of Seattle. So that would be like telling everybody in Seattle what to walk to Everett.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, oh, by the way, make sure in Everett you've created tentage, medical facilities, food and water to accommodate the people there are.
So this implies that there's going to be, I guess, some kind of airstrike. I thought that Israel was preparing, you know, more like a surgical invasion where they would somehow invade the last of the tunnels.
Well, they're talking about doing a full-fledged invasion. And part of the reason I think they sealed off that Egyptian crossing point was because there are clearly that's an area and tunnels as well that the Hamas has used to smuggle weapons, et cetera, from Egypt into the Gaza Strip. So they want to seal that particular area off and end that. But the strikes they're doing right now apparently are targets where they have been able to identify Hamas, either military strong points, Hamas leadership, probably caches of weapons. That's what we're seeing. I would imagine they're striking now using aircraft and artillery fire. Whether they then physically move in on the ground and begin that very arduous in an urban area door-to-door, room-to-room, building-to-building type operation, which I witnessed when I was in Iraq and places like Fallujah. That remains unclear. But clearly, with that large density of civilians, if you do that, you're going to have dramatic casualties on the civilian side. And right now, Dave, we're at somewhere over 34,000 Palestinians having been killed and over 78,000 having been injured in the fighting since it began in October.
So is there a way that this could stop if Hamas agreed? I mean, it seems to me that I was quite surprised to hear last night that Hamas had agreed to a ceasefire, and I assumed it was pushed to the brink because they saw that clearly the operation was about to begin. So are they trying to gauge what, how serious Israel is before they decide to finally surrender, or is that just not in the cards?
Well, it seems that Hamas has accepted this, but of course the question is, will Israel accept this? And so far they have refused to accept the deal that is made public. And the basic division point seems to be Hamas seeking a permanent ceasefire and an end of hostilities between them and Israel, and the Israelis only wanting a temporary ceasefire between them and Hamas. Since the beginning of the war, Mr. Netanyahu has insisted on the full destruction of Hamas as a major goal of this particular conflict. And obviously, anything short of that, allowing some portion of Hamas to survive frustrates that. But on the other hand, he's under increasing pressure in Israel and elsewhere around the world over the hostage situation.
Well, I mean, do you see any agreement that Israel would accept that allows Hamas to continue to have a presence? I mean, it sounds to me like if they want to stop this, they simply have to say, okay, we surrender.
Yeah. I think that's about right, or at least that Hamas, and we've seen this with the PLO, and the Israelis went into Lebanon, a large portion of the PLO leadership, may recall, were allowed to leave. This is Yasser Arafat many, many years ago, and I think went somewhere in North Africa, allow the leadership of Hamas to survive to leave the country. There has been some talk of that. But the problem you got on the one side, again, is the Israelis' desire for full destruction of Hamas, and Hamas right now with a full desire to survive and be able to stand up at the end of this conflict and say, we stood up to the Israelis. Look what we've accomplished in terms of isolating them internationally and bringing together countries across the region, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Houthis down in Yemen, et cetera, to oppose the Israelis.
What do you think about the demonstrations here in the U.S.? These are people who think that by demonstrating and calling for divestment, they could stop the fighting. Is there any world in which that would ever happen?
Well, it certainly, I think, has an effect upon the Biden administration politically. We're going to have an election, and I'm sure more and more people in the Democratic Party are worrying as they see youngsters out there demonstrating, will this cause Mr. Biden problems at the ballot box? Sadly, I am old enough to remember demonstrations like this back in the 1960s.
Yes.
But certainly over time had an influence on U.S. policy towards Vietnam.
Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst. Jeff, thanks very much.
Take care, Dave.
Time for your daily dose of kindness, brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. A Starbucks barista in Little Rock, Arkansas, had a memorable shift last month thanks to her cheerful demeanor and the kindness of a customer. And it played out in an unexpected and emotional way. Here's CBS's David Begno, who has a new segment on CBS Mornings called Dear David, which is a tribute to everyday kindness.
Okay, TikTok, I need your help. I'm hoping that this person is on.
Courtney Crawford is a Starbucks barista in Little Rock, Arkansas. She says she was working an early morning shift last month when a customer came in who appeared to be struggling. It was a rough morning. So Courtney did her best to put a smile on the customer's face. Then, about 10 minutes later,
she came in and she gave my manager a note and asked her to hand it to me. And so I was like, okay. It says, I travel a lot for work. That usually means late nights and very early mornings. You were the first face I saw this morning and you really brightened my day. I'm sure you are exhausted because life, right? That's all of us. But you deserve to know you made a difference in someone's day today just by being kind.
Mm. The customer signed the note, sincerely, the groggy woman at 5 a.m. And she left Courtney $200. Mm. But what she didn't know was how Courtney was going to use that. Mm. You see, this weekend will be Courtney's first Mother's Day without her mom, Tammy Lee, who died last June after battling cancer. And this is where the story really got me. Watch.
I decided that I was going to buy the urn that I have been looking at and bring my mom home for Mother's Day, and I had no idea how I was going to afford it. But the $200 you put in that note today allows me to spend Mother's Day with my mom, and I appreciate you so much for that.
Told you.
Oh, wow.
So here's the deal. Ooh. We found Courtney. She told me she works three jobs to make ends meet, didn't have the cash to buy the urn, which was around $200, the same amount that generous person gifted her.
That is David Begnaud.
Got the update on Boeing's Starliner 835 when we talk with CBS's Peter King. Right now, though, it is time to bring in Pulitzer Prize winning reporter David Farenthold from the New York Times. The big trial is underway and kind of a surprise witness. I mean, Donald Trump said he didn't expect Stormy Daniels to show up, but there she is. She is testifying. I'm reading the running coverage on your newspaper, and I'm not sure if Trump has claimed that he never met her or it didn't happen, as he had with other encounters, but it's going to be hard to claim that based on some of the details I'm reading here this morning.
Yeah, she's described not only, the initial meeting, but also that they had, that his, he sent sort of his, I don't want to use the word goon, he had sent a body man, ex-New York detective who was sort of like an errand runner for him as well as a bodyguard to go invite her to dinner with Trump.
She's been describing the hotel suite, describing it as much bigger than her home. At the time of this meeting, Trump was 60, she was 27. But I mean, all very interesting. But what is the legal reason for having her testify here when this is just about the payoff?
Well, the prosecutors have been trying to establish sort of what was being hidden. And remember, there's two parts to this case. One, that somebody hid something, somebody falsified documents, and that thing that was hidden was important enough that it could have swung an election. So that's why it's a felony. You're not just hiding something, you were hiding something that concealed the interference with an election. And so that thing is that Trump supposedly had this encounter with Stormy Daniels, and she was going to talk to the world about it in the days after the Access Hollywood tape. So, you know, we're going to see them describe the encounter that Trump wanted to hide, and then probably later ask her, you know, when you were paid to be silent, who paid you? What did they say to you? What did they say about why it was important that you be silent? And what did they say to you about Trump's role, either, you know, why Trump wanted you to be silent or what Trump's role was in paying you off? So I think that's going to be the back end of her testimony.
Okay, so you said this becomes important because one of the allegations is that he hushed her up for fear that publishing this story would swing the election, correct?
That's how you get this to be a felony. He's being charged with something called falsifying business documents, which normally is just a misdemeanor. But you have to, if you do it to cover up another crime, then it's a felony. And so in this case, the other crime is that he had, he paid off Stormy Daniels to improperly influence an election. This was a political contribution that was not reported. And so, you know, he lied in some internal records. And that's how you get sort of this two-step crime.
Right. So the idea that this could swing the election is key to this case. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely crucial. That's why they spent so much time last week on the Access Hollywood tape describing sort of how much in panic mode the Trump folks were, the Trump campaign was after the Access Hollywood tape, how desperately they wanted to avoid another thing that would sort of reinforce the image that came to us in the Access Hollywood tape. So that's why, you know, they all of a sudden cared so much about silencing Stormy Daniels, was because the election was approaching and he was already sort of taking on water because of Access Hollywood.
Okay. Well, now, I obviously, what I'm about to say is hindsight, but we have since established that the loyalty of Trump voters goes so deep that stuff like this, frankly, does not matter to them. Doesn't that undermine the idea that this might have swung the election?
Well, I actually don't know if they're going to get into sort of, you know, the state of the 2016 electorate, but I think you have to remember two things. One is that, yes, that was then when people didn't understand Trump's ability to withstand political crises that would have tanked other candidates. But also, you know, we're not talking about Trump voters. You know, we're talking about sort of hardcore people who go to his rallies. We're talking about swing voters, people that, you know, didn't really give that much thought to the election, didn't like Hillary Clinton, didn't like Donald Trump, had to vote for one of them. So, you know, to those people, this might have been important. And, you know, the 2016 election was so close that anybody, you know, even any small sliver of the electorate was important.
Okay, well, I guess they've got a point there. So once she finishes testifying and we establish that this, in fact, did happen, does that then close the case? I mean, do we finally, does it go to the jury?
No, we haven't heard from Michael Cohen yet. That's the most important witness, definitely the most troubled witness, but also the most important witness for the prosecution. Cohen, you know, the former fixer for Trump, is going to say, I paid off Stormy Daniels because Donald Trump told me to. And here, and I also lied in these documents because Donald Trump told me to. He's going to connect Trump to both the cover-up and the original crime. And, you know, obviously there's going to be a lot of questioning about Michael Cohen's credibility. He's already gone to jail for lying. But that I think what they're doing by putting all these other witnesses ahead of Cohen is to sort of lay out this architecture of, like, here are all these other people saying that these things happened, and then Cohen's going to come in and say they happened again. So you have more reason to believe him because you've seen other people tell the same stories.
Okay, now I'm reading this ongoing coverage in your papers. I'm talking to you, but this is interesting. Stormy Daniels says during her dinner with Trump, she asked about his wife. He told her, she said, not to worry because the two did not even sleep in the same room. Trump shakes his head slightly and gives a sour look as Daniels says he told her that he didn't sleep in the same room as his wife. Is part of this intended just flat out to embarrass him?
Well, and no, I mean, I guess I can't say for sure, but there is a legal reason for that. And Trump's defense in this case has been, I didn't pay off Stormy Daniels to win the election or to keep it from voters. I paid off Stormy Daniels to keep that story from my wife because I care so much about what my wife thinks of me, and that, you know, I didn't want her to see any more bad news about this thing I'd supposedly done when I was married to her. So I think it's important for prosecutors, or they may see it as important, to say there's no relationship there. It wasn't what he was that concerned about it. You know, this was not a man who hung on his wife's every feeling. So that defense of, like, I did this to protect it from my wife, not from the voters, doesn't hold water.
I see. So there's no point in paying $130,000 and not even sleeping with your wife. Yeah. Okay.
I guess that's the goal.
Okay. On the idea of holding him in contempt and putting him in jail. But just as somebody who's observed Trump for a long time, as a reporter for The New York Times, with a Pulitzer Prize in his pocket, you see any way that Trump is going to jail over this?
I really don't, both because the judge and the prosecutors have both said they don't want him to go to jail, and also because Trump's behavior has changed, actually. The things that he was doing initially to the posts he was making about witnesses and other people in this case that caused him to be held in contempt, he actually stopped doing that. He got fined one more time yesterday, but it was for something he'd done the week before. He seems to have stopped doing that. I mean, no one really reads Truth Social anyway, but to the people who read Truth Social, he's not doing that kind of thing anymore. And in fact, the lawyer yesterday, his lawyer, went to the judge and said, hey, he's thinking about posting. He's gonna attack you or someone else. You know, I just want to make sure that's outside the scope of the gag order. So Trump seems to be complying with that. The constant talk about putting him in jail seems to have changed his behavior, at least temporarily.
New York Times reporter David Ferenthel. David, thank you.
Thank you.
8:48, and now from the Gene Ursula Show, here is G. Scott to talk about the Met Gala,
which supports the
costume program at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And David Burbank is here. He's got the whole picture gallery. I saw Kim Kardashian with
10-inch waist.
Squeezed like the number 8.
In the corset.
Squeezed like the
Dave,
number 8.
Dave, I just want to make sure because you don't ever know.
Yeah.
Have you ever worn a corset yourself?
No.
Oh, okay.
Not even on stage?
I've worn tights, yeah. Mm. I've worn dress shields, but I've never worn a corset, no. Mm-hmm.
What'd you wear tights for?
But because he's a stage actor.
I don't know.
Yeah. No, when you're playing a like a medieval character and you have to do a funny dance, it's funnier when you're wearing tights.
Oh, I ain't know if you go to happy hour, put on some tights. I ain't know what you're doing.
Sometimes it feels good,
usually,
that compression. Yeah.
The compression.
Yeah. Wards against varicose veins.
The Met Gala is something like, I'm being serious for a second. It is something that I've always wanted to go to. Mm. It's still on my bucket list, right? It's every first Monday of May every single year, right? It is something to help raise money for the Metropolitan Museum's Art Costume Institute. People come there with all of the greatest fashions. And you're like, well, how can you go, G? Well, I might put a GoFundMe together. And just to guys give you an idea on cost, right? You can get a table. The minimum table is $350,000 for a table, right? And then for a single ticket individually is $75,000 if you want to just go for a ticket. So again, I might try to do that GoFundMe to do that. In 2022, they raised $22 million for that. And so usually what happens is when you see these celebrities going, it's not like they just pull out of the pocket and go do it. These big designer, the Dior's, Balmain, Louis Vuitton, all of the different big designers will grab celebrities that they know and love and think, ooh, Usher, who, by the way, looked great.
He looked great.
Usher, you would look great in this. Ooh, Kim Kardashian, let's put you in this. Put the little corset around you and all that kind of.
Ariana. Why is she getting all the attention? There were so many other better costumes than Kim Kardashian, I thought.
It was she's Kim Kardashian.
I mean, it's just
she
Kim Kardashian.
Yeah.
Hold on. Ariana Grande had on a corset.
Boring.
You know what I mean? Tyla was incredible in Balmain.
My favorite dress. The sand dress.
It was,
they had to carry her. She was like encased in what looked like sand.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And she had to have assistants carry her up the stairs and then she would pose.
Sounds practical.
So it was great. It was like she was in this sand corset and then the skirt became flowy at the end.
Right.
It was so, and then almost like she had gloves on where they wiped sand on her hands. Mm-hmm. It was amazing.
So here's, chances are I'm not going to be able to afford to go, and chances are the GoFundMe won't get enough. I probably might get up to about $425 and that won't be enough. But one of the things that really stands out to me about this event is that it's a mystery, because when you go inside, we see them on the red carpet, but once you see them on the red carpet and them interviews are done, when they go in, there's no cell phones, y'all. Nothing. No reporters. Nobody can go in there, so you don't get an opportunity to know. So what I was thinking was this. Me, Dave Ross, put together our own big party here where we don't allow cell phones or anything, and people get dressed to the nines to help raise money.
For journalism?
No.
Oh.
No. Help raise money for me to go to the Met Gala.
I see.
Okay.
A really worthwhile cause.
You see, I did that, Sonny? Come on, man. You know what I mean?
This thing is even on my radar, as you know. I have no idea.
At least I'm being honest with the calls.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. You know, whatever.
And
I can handle that.
And if you come, just know that 100% of the donations will go towards the cause.
Yeah, so you will wear your special sneakers and your gold, and I will wear my REI hiking outfit.
No! You wear your tights,
bro. What would the theme be? What do you want the theme to be? There's always a theme.
Oh, men in tights.
Men in tights.
Men in tights.
I love that. I could go so many places with dressing up for that.
Men in tights.
Uh-huh.
And so,
we're men in tights.
Absolutely.
Tights. Remember that movie?
No. Nobody?
By the way, how?
I thought that's what you were going with. You were going with the Dave Chappelle look from Men in Tights.
My question is, how tight?
Tight.
How tight the tights? Because you know how the baseball uniforms got in trouble for that.
Uh-huh.
Okay, we move on.
No.
Somewhere between baseball and men in ballet.
When G goes silent, it's time to move on.
No, the reason why I go silent, because sometimes I feel so comfortable on the show that I forget I'm on a radio show.
And that the FCC is always listening.
Right. Yeah. So because I know the FCC is listening and Dave's asking me how tight.
Yeah.
Tight, but not yeast infection tight.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, that'll pass. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.